This podcast is brought to you by Rototo. Experience intense space survival action in this mobile retro arcade game. A rotating shield is the only thing standing between the incoming alien horde and your inevitable destruction. How long can you last? Play now on iOS and Android.
We have a special guest today. His beard is known as the oncoming storm. He's an expert on loving single-page web apps. Please endorse him on LinkedIn for single-page web apps. Sam Pippen, how are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Hi, Derek. Okay. For anybody not familiar with Sam, you're on RSpec Core.
Yep.
You love Ember and Angular. And what else? What else are you known for?
I do. Yeah, I mean, the RSpec thing is the stuff I'm most known for. I also do quite a lot of consulting based in the UK. I do a lot of helping teams with making their Rails apps more performant, refactoring, helping them with tests, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Cool.
So when did Matchers become composable?
Matchers became composable as part of the RSpec 3 change.
Okay.
Right? So my understanding on the history of that is that between the release of RSpec 2.14, which is the final release in the 2 series, and the release of RSpec 3, work was done mostly by Myron Marsden, who is the lead maintainer on RSpec, to make matches composable. And that means that, you know, you can put one matcher inside another and RSpec will match your data structure in an arbitrarily nested way.
Yeah.
And you get good messages from that as well, which is interesting. I feel like we're just starting to catch on to that now. Like, the composable matchers thing is making its rounds at ThoughtBot right now.
Uh-huh.
And people are like, oh, this got in there. Like, I think everybody was really focused on getting from 2 to 3.
Yeah.
And then we kind of, like, relaxed a little bit. And then every once in a while, somebody's like, did you guys know you can do this on RSpec 3? It's like, oh, cool, this is really neat. Like, Spy was one that people were talking about a lot.
Well, Spy was actually not a new feature.
Oh, well, never mind then.
In RSpec 3.
It was just renamed from something.
Yeah, so a little known fact is that the CTO of ThoughtBot, Joe Ferris, is actually the one that implemented Spies in RSpec. And those were available definitely in 2.14 and possibly one release earlier. I'm not 100% on the history of that, but all we really did through RSpec 3 is we created aliases called spy, instant spy, method, like, and so on, that are actually just implemented as the corresponding double as null object.
Right.
So RSpec has this as null object method on all of its doubles, which makes them respond to all methods returning self, so that you can effectively dot chain any call off that. And then spying allows you to observe all of the calls that were then made on that.
I really liked when the spies landed, so thank you, Joe, because it let me get rid of Mocha and...
and Born.
And Born.
Which, I think that was why he did it, was because he was tired of maintaining Born.
Right, so... Sure. Which were the gems we used for stubbing and mocking.
Yeah.
Whatever.
If I make this feature in RSpec, it will be someone else's problem.
Right, exactly.
No, that's how pull requests work, right? It's like, here's some code I wrote. Please maintain it for the rest of your life.
Right, yeah. I think I did see that somewhere where it's like, yeah, exactly that, right? Like, I would like you to maintain this feature for the rest of your life.
Yeah. But no, the matcher stuff was really cool. I was really excited when I saw it, because I've been doing a lot of stuff with Hamcrest matchers lately.
Okay.
And it's just been really nice. You have, like, any of, all of, that sort of stuff. Are you familiar with Hamcrest?
No.
It's a Java thing, right?
Yeah, it's a JUnit library.
Okay.
It's what basically everybody uses for a DSL that's closer to RSpec in Java.
Sure.
And the matcher objects there were just really nicely designed in terms of composition. And I saw .and. Is there a .or as well?
Yeah, RSpec has a .or as well.
So there's and the equivalent would like, it would be a function in Java where the function's any of, and then that would take an arbitrary number, and then that does.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
we
really
have
cool.
Matches for any and all as well, and other, you know, arbitrary crazy nesting stuff.
Yeah, it's really cool though. I really like it. I'm happy now.
Thanks.
So thank you.
Although, like, I didn't do very much of
that. What is it that you're into in RSpec these days?
Most all of the committing work that I do is to do with RSpec mocks, actually. I think I probably have the most commits in that one. And that's because RSpec Mox sees the most interesting breakages of any of the parts of RSpec. And the core reason for that is that that's the part where we have to get like really intimate with the objects that users pass into the framework. Like most of the rest of RSpec is dealing nearly all of the time with RSpec objects, right? Or at the very most has to do like equality comparisons. Mm-hmm. But RSpec Mox does like removing methods from objects, putting new methods onto those objects, putting the old methods back, and like a bunch of shenanigans around that. And obviously with things like any instance, that becomes more complicated. And so basically all of the tickets that get filed against RSpec on GitHub these days that are genuine bugs as opposed to like feature asks or like tweaks to formatting or whatever are in RSpec Mox, and it's because like a user has concocted an object which is really interesting. So like, for example, the Ruby method send is used to like take a symbol and send a method to an object, right? Mm-hmm. Some people like have an email class which has a send method on it, which totally does not do that.
Yes, we've run into those issues before.
And so RSpec internally uses __send__ everywhere now to ensure that like we don't get tripped up by that one. And then there's like other stuff like what happens if an object gets frozen during the execution of a test that has mocks upon it. What if the users redefine the method? which like is a really obvious thing to do in an HTTP library, right? So actually the way we solve that problem is we take the instance method object method off kernel and rebind it to user objects when we need to do that. Mm-hmm. Like prepend was another one that did interesting, and so like it's just all stuff like that. And so I find those bugs like super fascinating, right? Like how did you end up in this state where like our mocking framework can't work with your object anymore, and then how do I fix it?
Right.
Yeah. And like all of those fix, like those are, that's where I sort of spend most of my time. And then I do a lot of, I try to find time to triage issues as well, because I live in the UK. Like I have the sort of time zone advantage where all of the issues that Europe files whilst we're awake, I can like triage before America wakes up, and then the other contributors have like issues to work against.
You mentioned any instance.
Uh-huh.
Do you want that to die? How are your feelings on that?
So actually, there was a feature proposal for RSpec 3 to make any instance configurable, so you could turn it on or off.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can turn on and off the should syntax. We were also discussing making those methods unavailable via a configuration option, which would probably have been turned on by default in RSpec 3. But, you know, we're moving to this place where RSpec is very configurable, but you can deactivate the parts of it that you don't like.
Right.
That said, I find that most of the time you don't want to reach for any instance, but sometimes people do, and being able to turn it on is like a useful thing to have, right? There are certainly no plans to ever remove any instance from RSpec.
Like I've looked into it before. I've looked into the code for it before and been like, oh boy, this looks like a lot of maintenance. Like
yeah, so like one thing that I observe that is echoed by a lot of people is that code that goes into gems, and especially really mature ones like RSpec, looks wildly different to any kind of application code that
Absolutely.
You're ever going to write.
Yeah. Yep.
'Cause the abstractions that you need are different, and also like the literal interface to your application is different, right? I think there are definitely parts of RSpec that could have the internals improved in a big way, but like everyone that works on it has limited time, and you know, we're all working as hard as we can, and it's fair to say that like everyone on the team is like a really good developer as well.
Are they though? Why are you on this podcast and not fixing RSpec bugs right now? I feel like you could be working harder.
Well, Sean, whose fault is that?
Sorry. We need God. We need Godfrey on here. We need to replace this right now with Godfrey going sorry.
Yeah, the any instance thing, like you made the perfect, like there are just times when you're like, you know, it'd be nice right here if I just call any instance. Like I was working with Melanie, one of our developers, months ago, and we were trying to figure out we wanted to stub this object, but then it was found from this other method. We're like, okay, we got to stub this thing to return this object. And then, like, we just couldn't get it to work. And she's like, ah, get any instance. And I was like, okay, let's do it.
I do find it's a thing you reach for when you're dealing with legacy code also. When you can't, like, you just cannot re-architect it to use dependency injection.
Yeah. Right.
And that used to be, I believe, the, like, generators for controller specs used any instance at one point, right? Where it was like...
Maybe.
So you could say, like, maybe it was so you didn't have to stub find or something like that. I forget exactly.
Sure.
Why,
yeah, I can't recall the exact specifics of that either, but I do know that the reason any instance was added was a big push by Andy Linderman, who was the lead maintainer of RSpec Rails for a while. So it's fair to assume that that has a use in RSpec Rails and testing Rails in general, but like, I agree with you, Sean, that like sometimes you need any instance for testing legacy code, and obviously, like, of the two testing frameworks that anyone uses in Ruby, RSpec is much more amenable to testing legacy code than Minitest, right? Because, like, at least the way I think about RSpec, and I think maybe some other people on the core team share this, is that RSpec is a tool that lets you write literally any test you can think of, and it's up to you to decide whether or not the test that you're writing is a good test, right? Because, like, the mocking and stubbing capabilities in RSpec really do let you do anything to any object anywhere in the system, and then it's, like, it's up to you to know whether or not what you're doing is a good idea. And so, like, if you're refactoring some, like, really glued together horrible legacy architecture, then maybe you need any instance. But if you're, like, greenfielding a new Rails app or even, like, a not Rails app, you probably don't, right?
It's just such a strange idea to hear you say that, because in Ruby it feels like we're so used to everything is really opinionated.
Uh-huh.
And just the idea that, like, we're just a tool that is going to let you do whatever the hell you want, and we don't care, and it's up to you to decide if that's good or not, that just sounds so alien.
Sure. Well, like, RSpec does have a small set of warnings that it issues that we have aggregated into best practices, but, like, as a tool, it is very, very flexible in what you can do with it. And maybe it's true that, like, that is alien, but RSpec is a very popular testing framework, so people clearly like this idea.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't saying it's bad. I was just saying it's interesting and different.
Uh-huh. Well, it's, and I think, especially for the people whose, like, core job it is to refactor other people's applications, like, RSpec is the only tool that they can use to get that done.
Yeah.
So why is that? Like, I'm not familiar. Like, last night at the bar, we were talking about there's this rotating bar at the hotel we're staying.
Yeah,
at,
it's
and somebody left a note on the side that said RailsConf 2015 mini test or RSpec, and you had to check a box, and you're like, that was like a poll.
And so every time you go around,
right? So every, like, the next person that spins around pulls it up and, like, checks off what they think. Uh-huh. And so, like, I was like, RSpec, and Ellie, another one of our developers, was like, why RSpec and not mini test? And so, like, she wanted to get into this conversation, and I was like, I don't actually know. I don't, like, RSpec was what I learned, and so now RSpec is what I do. So I have no idea, like, when you say that RSpec can do anything and Minitest is a little more opinionated, like, in what types of things would I not be able to do with Minitest? Do you know?
Okay, so I need to prefix this following statement with the warning that I have an extremely biased opinion, given that I am on the RSpec core team.
Perfectly fine.
But Minitest does not have the same set of stubbing and mocking capabilities that are available to you in RSpec. They're very, very limited. Mm-hmm. You can only stub... I need to make sure I get this correct, because I'll get in trouble.
Don't worry about it.
So Minitest has a double like object that is similar to RSpec's.
I've looked for this. You mean Minitest mock?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is a double... It's a double like object, right?
Well, sure, but the order of calls becomes important.
Yeah. So by default, the order of calls is important. Mm-hmm. Mini mocks do not respond to equal by default. It doesn't auto-verify things that you do. And also, you can't do the same set of stubbing and mocking on real objects. Mm-hmm. And you'll have to talk to Ryan Davis to find out exactly what those capabilities are, because I don't have them memorized. But, like, there is no any instance in Minitest. There is no stubbing on constants, right? Where, you know, in RSpec you can use stub const to, like, swap out the implement. And, like, the idea is, of course, that doing those things might be bad testing practice. And so Minitest does not let you do them.
But I do find when I am writing mini, like, when I do have to go into a client and they're writing Minitest, I'm not super familiar with it, but I'm like, oh, I can't stub this constant.
Yeah.
I really, like, I don't want to have to rewrite this entire thing so I can inject my dependency. I just want to stub this constant.
Right.
Can I do that, please?
Right. Yeah. Like, exactly.
And that's the thing, right? Like, when you're maintaining other people's code or dealing with legacy code, you're a lot more likely to reach for these things. Whereas with Greenfield, like, you do just build it with dependency injection from the get-go, right?
But, like, the whole point of Minitest is it's the testing framework by Ryan Davis for Ryan Davis, right? Or at least that's probably a bit too aggressive. But what I mean by that is, like, Ryan has a very particular style of writing his code. He thinks that style is good. Minitest is the test framework that is optimized to support writing code in that style.
Right.
Other people have definitely, like, merged patches into it, but it has, like, a clear vision of, like, this is for the people that want to test Greenfield apps in a, like, super strong TDD way and do it completely correctly, and you can't, like, screw up your tests in such a way that you're going to hate yourself in 6 months, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, in RSpec, you can totally do all of those bad practice testing things. Yep. One that I see that, like, shocked me the first time I saw it is people stubbing the object under test.
Yep.
Which is just simply impossible in Minitest.
It happens all the time. Like, I review code all the time, especially in controller specs a lot. And in view specs. View specs, there's almost no way around it. Like, sometimes you have to just stub the view for current user or whatever.
Yeah. I then question the usefulness of view specs. But
yeah, same with controller tests, especially if you're trying to isolate things. Like, your controller is your main function. You wouldn't try and test your main function in isolation.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, but you can. I think there's fewer good reasons to stub the subject under test when you're in controller specs than when you're in view specs. Like, when you're in controller specs, if you want to stub current user, you can just fake out however current user gets set.
Sure.
Sure.
Right? So, like, I'm, like, very strongly of the opinion you should never, ever stub the object under test. Like, that for me is the, like, number one testing smell. Like, when I see that,
yep,
I am certain there is something wrong. But, like, it's interesting that you mentioned not testing controller specs in isolation, especially with regards to the keynote this morning and some of the other things that have been bouncing around at the conference, because I apparently think about controller tests in a different way to at least Aaron. Because to me, the purpose of a controller test is to sort of, on one side, test sending the method coming in, and basically the get and post there are just merely wrappers around faking up the, like, Rails request object, and you're actually sending the method. It's not about the HTTP request at that point.
But it is, though, because it's a controller. That's, like, that is its responsibility is HTTP.
But that's what you're testing when you get higher.
Sure.
Like, all I'm testing, like, when I do controller tests, and I was thinking about this
But then the other side is testing the instance variables that come out. Because that's the actual interface to the controller, is the request and the instance variables.
Right, and this is the argument that, I mean, this is what started coming out when we announced that we were deprecating assigns and assert template in Rails 5, is that for some people, they see that as the return value of the controller.
Yeah.
I don't know, because that seems like if you were to take an object, stub out a private method, and then assert that, called that private method. Like, if you rename the template, that's not a thing that should cause your test to fail.
So I agree. I usually don't assert on the template, but I do assert on the instance variables. And that's because that's what, like, the actual interface, right? It's sort of the same as testing that parameters are getting passed correctly to a command method by mocking.
But you also just argue that view specs aren't necessarily helpful. Like, if you're just testing that called it has the right inputs to this template, but you've never then tested that when given the right inputs, it does the right thing.
So then you would write an integration test.
Right, but
the
key being you can write an integration test that covers most of those things, and then you can write a controller spec that covers some of the edge cases without having to do the integration test, right?
Right.
So, like, what I do controller specs for a lot is, like, does it handle this error condition gracefully? That's what I do them for.
Sure.
And I think I could probably, if integration tests were much faster, I could probably replace that with integration tests.
Yeah, so, like, I find the idea that speeding up the integration feature tests is going to be a big help from that point of view. I mean, certainly removing assigns is going to change the way that controller tests are implemented, period, the end.
Yeah, I mean, right? I mean, that's the thing. When you remove those two things, it was like Aaron showed, the main difference is that you pass a path and not the name of an action.
Right, exactly.
And you do actually gain a lot. Like, if you've ever tried to pass a custom header, request header to the controller, like, it's a pain in the ass in controller tests. If because we skip the entire middleware stack, there's some weird funky things that you might want to assert that it returns a 404, but it's not. You're going to assert raises active record record not found because the middleware that rescues that isn't there. And
sure,
but some things are easier to test in a controller test, like session, right? So, like, it's easier for me to set a session up in a controller test than it is for me to do it in an integration test.
All of the methods, literally every other method in integration in controller, other than assigns and assert template, there's an equivalent.
But if I'm running the entire stack, right, isn't my session going to get clobbered by what my actual session is?
Only with capybara.
Right.
If you just call get, in the in the integration test, then no.
Sure. Okay.
Interesting.
And then that's the other thing is all of the discussions that are happening like in the Rails team and in Aaron's keynote and in David's keynote, like don't assume capybara.
Right.
Because it's not. And there's it has been discussed whether capybara should be in our stack by default, and it has been actively chosen not to be.
Right. But then RSpec just gives it to you. So.
Right, and everybody uses it. But
When I think integration tests, I think capybara tests. I don't make an integration test for anything. Maybe I would do a request spec for like an API. That's it.
But that's what I mean, just to give context as to where those arguments are coming from. They are not assuming capybara. So.
Sure. Okay. And actually, like, I guess the point is request specs, controller specs, pick one.
Right.
And the Rails core team has just decided that everyone has to pick request specs now, right?
Yep.
Or integration tests, as Rails calls them. And, like, that's fine, too. And I think it's maybe just a matter of personal style, right? Yeah. I certainly know Sarah May, the first thing she does when she walks up to a new client application is she turns on render views in the controller specs. And at that point, you are literally just writing request tests without the router. Like, that is the majority of the difference, right?
Yeah.
That's funny, because the first thing I do is when I see render views on controller specs is I turn it off.
Yeah, so like...
Well, actually, I assume that that's how they're doing integration tests, and I go, oh, we should be doing this differently.
But. Yeah.
But that's perfectly fine. Like, maybe I should stop doing that and be like, no, this is just the highest level. I mean, for the longest time, it was kind of the highest level that people tested at.
Sure.
Well, it is. It's the highest level in your application, though. Like, that is exactly, it is your main function.
Uh-huh.
Without any of the middleware. Which, you know, handles everything. But, you know, other than that.
We do handle a lot in middleware. True story, can confirm.
But now it will have the middleware, I guess. So
yeah.
In Rails 5 question? that was what Aaron said.
Well, yes. Presumably Rails 5 won't go out the door until this is settled and finished. So,
Well, I mean, Rails 5 is going to go out in August-ish.
Ish.
Pretty much, no matter what.
There's a date.
Big announces.
There's a reveal.
When are we getting the source code for Action Cable?
When are we getting the source code for Action Cable? We would all like to see this. Yes, I agree. There are a lot of discussions and concerns that need to be addressed that we cannot even begin the discussions until we can see some source code.
Sure. So I was quite ill, so I slept through most of the keynote, but I had it live streaming in my hotel room. And the one part I heard that sort of piqued my attention was a mention of it using Redis directly.
Yes.
So, like, at the moment, right, Rails has adapters for all databases that it knows about, right? Like, it has a Postgres adapter and a SQLite adapter and so on. And, like, are we hoping that some of that code will be reusable into Action Cable? Or, like, we'll get a Redis adapter for Action Cable? Or...
Well, no, I mean, it's not using Redis as a replacement for a persistent data store. It's using Redis to handle PubSub.
Sure. No, I get that, but... I guess there are other, I mean, like, Postgres totally has a PubSub mechanism
built
into it,
right? Yeah, and that's exactly
right?
What I was thinking of when he was talking about that, was like, shit, I think I'm going to have to add Postgres PubSub support to Active Record now.
Yes! Because, like, Redis is great and all, but it's got some reliability issues. And, you know, if the whole point is to get things like notifications or chat messages down to... web apps faster, then like reliability is going to be pretty essential, right? And I guess the other thing that I'm interested to hear about is transport negotiation, because that's like really hard for like web browsers and long running connection systems, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
is this basically what we just talked about with Sam Saffron?
He was talking about message bus and specifically why it no longer uses WebSockets and the issues they've had with WebSockets.
Sure.
And the fact that he does not think that we actually gain anything from using WebSockets over well-implemented long polling.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, I don't know the answers to these. You have as much information as I do.
Sure. I just enjoy speculating wildly and gesticulating.
Yeah, don't wait for the facts. Just
no. Well, like... So a good friend of mine, a guy named James Coughlin, works on a WebSocket PubSub framework called Faye. Mm-hmm. And one of the parts of Fae is a subsystem called Bayou, which is a transport negotiation for long-running connections between a web browser and a server that is aware of this. And mm-hmm. he was just like, by the way, implementing transport negotiation in web browsers is a nightmare.
Yeah.
But if you don't do it, you're definitely going to drop messages. If you do do it, you're only likely to drop messages. So yeah, the other thing that like I find really interesting about all this is that like for the longest time, Rails has been like RESTful HTML rendering apps as a like very high speed like Ruby command line, right? And in fact, 2 years ago, David, like his keynote was Rails is the best at server side rendering ever. The keynote. And now, like, Rails is getting all of these front-endy bits, and I feel like that's almost a bit of a contradiction, right?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, also, David's not the only one pushing for a lot of this, and the Rails API thing was something that a lot of people have been pushing for a long time, mm-hmm. and there's actually very little practical difference. Like, the diff in that pull request was larger than I expected it to be, but... you know, the idea is we strip out view rendering stuff, right? Because we're never going to render views, and that'll make everything faster and more lightweight. Mm-hmm. Except it really doesn't actually change the performance characteristics in any meaningful way.
Right.
But the fact that there is a Rails new --- API and something is being done does have an emotional value to it. Like, it's more of a, just a statement of like, hey, we want you guys using Rails as well.
Sure.
I do think we need to switch to active model serializers, though, as the default... JSON generation for APIs.
Good luck with that.
It's being discussed, and it's leaning towards that. For API specifically, JBuilder still being the default for apps that serve both HTML and JSON. But we're actually starting to, I think, reach a consensus that just if you're building an API, the active model serializes API makes a little bit more sense.
Sure.
Because the single canonical representation becomes much more important.
Yeah, right. Like, you don't want your tree of nested JSON values to look funky. You want them always to look the same.
Yeah, well, and you want show to give the exact same thing as index, but in array form.
Yeah, for sure, right? And this is, I mean, you partially get that with the, like, format blocks now, right?
Yeah. You can definitely do it with both. I don't know, but anyway, yes, it is a contradiction, but going back
that's
to
that's okay.
The,
we can have contradictions. It's been 2 years, right?
Yeah, sure. We had a whole major version of Rails.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I contradict myself all the time. I hope people don't hold me to that standard.
I'm pretty sure I contradict myself every episode.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Every pull request, almost.
Yeah.
What else? I know you got to run at like 2:30, right, or something?
Yeah.
Anything else you want to plug or anything else you're really excited about?
Things I want to plug. I mean, I like doing consulting in the US. I'm available. You can email me at sam@funandplausible.com, which is my email address, or find me on Twitter or whatever.
We'll link both of those things in the show notes.
We are going to have to bleep out your email address. We can't have a competitor pitching on air.
Sorry. I'm the worst. Yeah, I don't know, really. I'm terrible at pitching. Watch my talk video. I did a talk at the conference.
Oh, how'd it go?
I think it went quite well.
You weren't feeling well.
Yeah, I was really ill yesterday morning, and that, like, carried over. And I had a really, like, bad headache, but some people said it was good.
So, powered through it.
Yeah.
Good job.
I mean, it was in the beginner track, so, like, not too much pressure, right?
We were talking at the same time, so I didn't get to see it.
And I also didn't get to see it because I was at his
being,
time.
I made him come to mine. Emotional moral support.
Yeah.
Great.
All right, cool. Let's
thanks,
wrap up.
Guys.
Yeah, let's wrap up. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/19.
Thanks again to our guest, Sam Pippin.
Mm-hmm.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any others, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.